America, as we all know, is in very serious economic trouble. And unless forceful new national strategies are put in place, we will lose our economic future and our social order.
We could see the dollar cease to be the world standard, and I think people will be very surprised when that happens.
That might just begin a kind of a trade war, which would hurt both countries and affect the whole trading world.
Trade wars, cheating the rules, currency threats. To those of us who have seen U.S.-China headlines over the past few years, this all sounds familiar. But these quotes are not from the past few years, and they are not about the country you think. In the 1980s and 1990s, America's chief trade nemesis was not China. It was Japan. In just 20 years, Japan rebuilt its economy from the rubble of World War II into the world's factory, growing at double digits year after year for over a decade. With lightning speed, previously unknown Japanese conglomerates became global leaders. By the 1980s, it seemed like just a matter of time before Japan replaced the US as the largest economy in the world. But that never happened. By the 1990s, Japan's economy stalled and has struggled to recover ever since. What brought Japan's rapid growth to a near standstill? And how did Japan at one point become the world's second largest economic powerhouse in the first place? What can we learn from Japan's meteoric rise to economic superpower and its economic slowdown? And how can trade wars of the past inform our current moment?
In the next 45 minutes, we'll dive into Japan's economic miracle and its aftermath, from Japan's record-setting rise to its present stagnation. We'll discuss in depth how careful economic strategy powered Japan into the top tier of the world's economies, and how that strategy makes Japan's economic system so different from the rest of the world's. Finally, we'll confront the challenges that faced Japan after the miracle faded. Did Japan's economic strategy backfire? Are global politics to blame? Or did free markets fail to deliver on its promises? This is the story of Japan's economic miracle. Chapter 1 will review the early days of Japan's post-war recovery. Chapter 2 will go more in depth, explaining the ins and outs of Japan's economic growth, system, and unique business structure. In Chapter 3, we'll discuss the global trends that confronted Japan's growth. By the end of this podcast, you'll be up to speed. Let's get started.
Chapter 1. Post-war Japan, a nation in ruins. The year is 1945. And Japan had formally accepted defeat in World War II. Though the war was finally over, years of fighting had wrought destruction over the nation. Thousands of Japanese soldiers had perished overseas, leaving many families exhausted with grief. At home, surviving families faced poverty and hunger as many of Japan's cities and towns were bombed to shreds. Countless communities and livelihoods were destroyed, and food shortages were rampant. Upon Japan's surrender, the U.S. sent thousands of military personnel to occupy Japan. The U.S. had seen how past mistakes after World War I had led to a resurgence of militarism that led the world back to war in World War II, and U.S. leaders were determined not to repeat this grisly history. The goal of U.S. occupying forces was to demilitarize and stabilize Japanese politics and society. The hope was that a prosperous Japan would never again turn to militarism and belligerence in the future. The U.S. also saw an opportunity to shape its former enemy into a U.S. ally in the crucial East Asian region. To this effect, U.S. occupying forces influenced Japanese leaders to draft and adopt a new democratic constitution. Notably, the new constitution included a pledge that the Japanese government would never raise an offense-oriented military, with the understanding that the U.S. would provide for Japan's military security. The U.S. wanted to promote stability in Japan through economic growth, but with Japan's industrial base and resources severely damaged after the war, economic recovery would be no easy feat. Among several other measures to start Japan's recovery, the Japanese government embarked on an ambitious program of land reform, breaking up large land holdings and redistributing the land to smaller farmers, which set the stage for greater prosperity in the countryside. the Japanese economy received a further economic boost from U.S. military operations at the onset of the Korean War from 1950 to 1953. Japan was used as a staging ground for United Nations forces operating on the Korean Peninsula, and Japanese suppliers benefited from lucrative wartime contracts. By 1952, the U.S. ended its occupation and Japan regained its sovereignty. Finally, under its own control, the Japanese government endeavored to restore and stabilize the country through strong economic growth. The question now was how.
Chapter 2, The Making of Japan's Economic Takeoff, 1950s to 1960s. The story of Japan's economic takeoff begins with Japan's unique economic vision. Many of Japan's leaders had a distinct vision for the future of their nation, with economic growth being their top priority. Japan's leaders settled on a vision of growth that prioritized rapid development, an export-led economy, and advanced technology. High-value exports were particularly important because Japan lacked natural resources and depended on earning money abroad to import the food, energy, and other resources it needed. But how would Japan fulfill this vision of rapid development, strong exports, and advanced technology, especially when Japan was so far behind the rest of the world? One of the leading examples for how to build a vibrant, advanced economy was the free market model used in the USA. However, Japan's leaders decided that the free market model practiced in America would be insufficient to develop Japan's economy and catch up to the rest of the world. Japan's leaders believed that strong interventions were needed to jumpstart heavy industry and promote world-leading corporations that would be owned by Japanese citizens rather than foreign investors. What little resources were available in the Japanese economy would have to be used wisely, and Japanese leaders believed that the free market should not be trusted to allocate those resources and build up the kinds of industries and corporations that the leaders wanted. Instead, Japan's economic planners believed that the state should step in to make sure that those resources were used as effectively as possible to create the specific kind of economy they wanted, an economy of rapid growth, strong exports, and advanced technology, and domestic Japanese ownership. Rather than follow the free market model of the U.S., Japan forged its own path of state interventionism to manage the Japanese economy.
Japan's economic statecraft. It would require a developed and powerful state to implement the state interventions that Japanese leaders desired to manage the economy. Japan had a prior history of strong state capacity. Japan's bureaucracy was elite, high-skilled, and intelligent, recruiting the top graduates from Japan's top universities. Japanese bureaucrats became very knowledgeable about the Japanese economy and formed close relationships with managers in Japan's biggest firms, allowing Japanese bureaucrats to carefully evaluate economic activity and recommend solutions. These bureaucrats released economic reports and set influential goals and benchmarks for the economy, focusing on sectors of interest. Importantly, successful bureaucrats often moved into political and leadership positions within the government, bringing with them specialized knowledge, experience, and influential political and business networks. This civil service to senior leadership pipeline was facilitated by relative political stability with a single party, the Liberal Democratic Party, LDP, holding control almost every year from 1955 to 2009. This strong state capacity and remarkable political stability helped the political leadership and civil service pursue long-term goals for Japan's economic development. The government of Japan had several powerful levers to direct businesses, banks, and other major economic actors to take actions that aligned with government goals. First, the government created a highly protectionist economy that limited foreign investment, imports, and influence. The Japanese government had the power to screen all imports that might compete with Japanese-produced goods, shielding Japanese firms from foreign competition at home. But the government did not close off the economy entirely. The government sought to attract foreign technology to leapfrog Japan's nascent industries, and the government took an active role in securing that technology. No foreign technology could enter Japan without the government's approval, and the government often stepped in to pressure foreign firms to license technology to Japanese firms on very favorable terms. The Japanese government also screened all foreign transactions with Japanese firms, including investments, licenses, and patent deals, to ensure that Japanese firms could benefit from foreign technology while preserving Japanese ownership and innovation. In this way, the Japanese government contributed heavily to increasing the technological capacity of the nation at a very low cost.
Beyond protectionism, one of the government's most powerful tools for coordinating the economy was the government's control over almost all loans and financing within the nation. In post-war Japan, businesses desperately needed loans and investment to rebuild and develop, but loans were incredibly scarce. The government heavily restricted the flow of foreign financing into Japan to prevent foreign companies from owning Japanese assets or developing Japanese industries. This meant that the Japanese economy would have to rely on its own limited domestic financial resources for investment and development. These domestic financial resources were almost entirely controlled by the state-owned Bank of Japan, which meant that the bank had sole power to offer the loans and investment financing that businesses so desperately needed. It's difficult to overstate the importance of the government's control over financing for businesses. Around this time, businesses relied on loans ultimately controlled by the government for 70 to 80% of their capital. This gave the Bank of Japan the ability to choose which businesses, industries, or projects receive financial support, and Japanese leaders used this power to channel Japan's limited resources to support the state's goals and economic vision. This state-coordinated rationing of financing was markedly different from the free market model used in the U.S., where loans were available from many private sources and the government took a step back to allow the free markets to determine which firms or industries got financing. The Japanese government used its control over financing to coordinate economic activities by issuing administrative guidance. Administrative guidance was the government's instructions to companies and banks on which industries should receive financing, which projects should be undertaken, which partnerships should be made, and more. This administrative guidance was published by one of the most powerful industries in the Japanese government, the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI, based on state-run economic evaluations. It's important to note that the administrative guidance was not law, and companies and banks were not legally required to follow the state's administrative guidance. Banks and companies that followed the guidance would receive financing directly or indirectly from the government at very low interest rates, sometimes near zero, making investment extremely affordable. However, companies and banks that did not follow the guidance could see their financing supply cut off by the Japanese government or could face much higher interest rates. So most companies and banks actively tried to follow the administrative guidance. They could not afford not to. So how did the Japanese government use this administrative guidance, backed by other powerful tools of influence, to coordinate the economy? Well, the government used this guidance to designate which industries should receive investment and even designated how much investment each industry should receive over a given period of time. Banks and businesses would adjust their business decisions and investment strategies to align with this guidance, focusing on industries prioritized by the government, or else risk losing access to low-interest financing. The government also offered sizable tax breaks for favored industries. Moreover, the government used administrative guidance and very close relations between the government and businesses to pick favored companies. In other words, designating winners and losers among firms. Firms favored by the government would receive lucrative licenses or special incentives in the form of cheap loans, tax breaks, and looser regulations. Many firms would actively strive to fulfill the state's administrative guidance in order to be considered a favored firm. Finally, the Japanese government leveraged personal relationships, administrative guidance, and other policy tools to influence certain firms or banks to merge together or partner up into larger conglomerates. These large conglomerates came to be called keiretsu. The government promoted the formation of very large keiretsu because the state believed that only large corporations could carry out the large investments in economies of scale required for the heavy industries the government desired, such as shipbuilding, petrochemicals, manufacturing, and more. The government strongly incentivized smaller companies in different industries or even smaller competitors in the same industry to merge together to form these large conglomerates, often with a long-term bank partner. You've probably heard of some of these keiretsu: Toyota, Nissan, Mitsubishi, and Toshiba, just to name a few, are now international household names. While each keiretsu has a distinct history and practices, in general, keiretsu developed business practices that were unique from much of the rest of the world and became a defining aspect of Japan's unique economic system.
The Japanese business landscape, the keiretsu system. to understand how keiretsu grew to become Japan's national champions and fierce competitors on the global stage, it is important to look to the particular business structure and practices that characterized keiretsu during this time. Keiretsu have their historical roots in conglomerates that existed in Japan before World War II, known as zaibatsu. These zaibatsu were large, industrial, family-owned conglomerates that helped power the Japanese imperial forces during World War II. After the war, the new Japanese government, backed by U.S. occupying forces, dismantled the zaibatsu in the late 1940s to limit their power. However, by the 1950s, the Japanese government came to recognize that large industrial conglomerates would be needed to rebuild the country's industrial base and power Japan's economic recovery. The government began to influence smaller firms to merge together and partner with banks, recreating the old family-owned zaibatsu system in the form of corporately owned keiretsu. In terms of firm structure, the keiretsu were different from American corporations in several ways. First, each keiretsu had a long-term partnership with a certain bank, and often this partnership was encouraged by the state. The partner bank would own equity in the keiretsu it made loans to. Thus, the keiretsu became dependent on a certain bank for much of its financing, and the bank was in turn dependent on the success of the keiretsu. This long-term mutual relationship incentivized banks to take a long-term, trusting, and cooperative view of their investments in their partner keiretsu. The keiretsu was transparent with their banking partner about the state of their finances, operations, and investments. And in turn, the banking partner was more willing to offer loans to fund long-term, potentially risky endeavors, even in hard times. This banking relationship is very different from the U.S., where U.S. collusion laws discourage banks from forming such close or preferential relationships with firms. In the U.S., companies in general face more pressure from banks to deliver higher profits or take on shorter-term loans, and there's less transparency or trust between companies and banks. This keiretsu bank partnership system allowed the keiretsu to resist short-term profit pressures and instead undertake the long-term investments required to grow Japan's domestic industry. Keiretsu also formed preferential relationships with their suppliers. Each keiretsu worked with their own specific set of suppliers, forming long-term, flexible, and trusting partnerships with their specific suppliers. For example, two competing car manufacturing keiretsu would each have their own set of suppliers for the car parts needed in the final product. Often under guidance from the government, each keiretsu would develop a long-term relationship with their specific supplier, rather than forcing its suppliers to constantly compete with other suppliers for the keiretsu's business. Thus, the keiretsu and its specific set of suppliers depended on each other for their own success over the long term. As such, suppliers were more willing to accept lower profits to help their partner keiretsu compete in hard times, and the keiretsu were more willing to share profits with its suppliers in good times. The keiretsu would even work collaboratively with its suppliers to lower costs or increase efficiency, for example by incorporating supplier feedback into the design of the final product. By contrast, U.S. conglomerates, notably U.S. car manufacturers, tended to have more adversarial, short-term relationships with suppliers as all suppliers competed against each other for more short-term deals with U.S. conglomerates. The keiretsu's long-term and cooperative supplier relationships helped make keiretsu more competitive globally.
Keiretsu also tended to have more long-term cooperative relationships with employees. Partially due to supportive relationships with the government, banks, and suppliers, keiretsu were able to offer substantial security for many of their workers. These workers enjoyed lifetime employment and received continuous training from the keiretsu to maintain or update their skills. This lifetime employment was complemented by a hierarchical seniority system in which workers received wages the longer they stayed with the company. The job security and seniority system contributed to strong workplace morale and formed a culture in which employees were invested in the long-term success of the keiretsu. As such, labor strikes were far less common in Japan compared to the United States, where business labor relations were much more adversarial and competitive. Japanese automakers, also keiretsu, were known to incorporate employee feedback into their production system in the form of continuous learning. The Toyota production system has gained global recognition for its unique practices, which contribute to low costs and high productivity. In the Toyota production system, the factory managers would work with employees to come up with specific production goals. For example, reducing the time it took for each car door installation by 10 seconds. With these production goals, the employees would then explain what changes would need to be made in order to meet them. For instance, reconfiguring the factory floor, changing the setup of a certain machine, even working with the firm suppliers to redesign a certain part to be easier to install. Workers would even get bonuses if they made a suggestion that saved the firm money. This feedback system helped workers feel valued and helped the Keiretsu continuously learn how to improve its production to cut costs and make fewer mistakes. By the 1960s, Japanese automakers following the so-called Toyota production system consistently outperformed American automakers, making higher quality cars in fewer minutes with fewer employees with fewer costly mistakes. The Keiretsu's cooperative labor relationships were instrumental in helping Keiretsu become dominant global competitors, as well as in contributing to the social and economic development and well-being of Japan's population at large. While many Keiretsu received benefits and advantages from the government, Keiretsu engaged in somewhat regulated competition between each other across several different industries, often at the direction of the state. As Japan's economic development progressed, the government would identify new or emerging strategic industries to prioritize, and then would deliberately encourage competition between Keiretsu by incentivizing several Keiretsu to enter an industry, creating an oligopoly rather than a monopoly in each industrial sector. Once in the new industry, the Keiretsu would compete with each other to be the most efficient in hopes of lowering costs and receiving greater government favors. Each Keiretsu came to encompass several subdivisions across multiple industries, and competed with other Keiretsu in each industry. Encouraged by the state, a one-set policy emerged among some of the largest Keiretsu, in which each Keiretsu would span an entire set of diverse industries, including banking, insurance, trading, steel, chemicals, shipping, and more. These highly diversified Keiretsu would compete with each other in each industry they encompassed, preventing the formation of monopolies and enhancing the efficiency of Keiretsu across the board.
Debates surrounding Japan's coordinated economic system. To summarize, so far we've described Japan's economic system as a coordinated economy in which the government plays the role of chief coordinator, using a strong bureaucracy and elite civil service to make decisions, to coordinate businesses and banks, and direct the economy to become export-oriented, high-tech, and Japanese-owned. The government did this by erecting protectionist barriers that shielded Japanese firms from foreign competition and forced Japanese firms to become innovators in their own right. The Japanese government had almost full control over access to finance and loans, which the government used alongside tax benefits, licenses, and loose regulation to incentivize firms to follow government-issued guidance about how the economy should develop. The government extended special treatment to develop certain firms and promote the formation of large industrial Keiretsu conglomerates, which grew into national champions and preeminent global competitors. These Keiretsu had their own particular business practices, which allowed them certain advantages over more established Western competitors. But not everyone believed in the merits of Japan's unique approach. Japan's coordinated economy drew both praise and criticism from international as well as domestic observers. Proponents of the Japanese government's coordinated economy approach believe that the government played an important role in promoting the growth of large national champions by protecting them in their early stages from foreign competition and ownership, and encouraging the formation of competitive, economically efficient, large-scale Keiretsu. Proponents also praise the Japanese government for stepping in to allocate preferential financing to high-risk, high-investment industries that the free market would have spurned, including steel manufacturing, shipbuilding, petrochemicals, and more. Overall, the Japanese government is largely credited for intervening to create the specific conditions and arrangements that led to Japan's rapid miracle growth and development, and that this growth would not have happened without the Japanese government's significant and systematic interventions in the market. However, free market-minded observers question the limits of Japan's coordinated economy. Critics contend that Japanese state intervention distorted the free market in ways that would ultimately hinder Japan's economic advancement in the long run, even if these distortions helped the Japanese economy catch up to Western economies at first. Free market-minded critics claim that Japan's substantial state support for keiretsu, including near zero interest rate loans, tax breaks, licenses, and other benefits, would make keiretsu bloated, inefficient, and dependent on unsustainable state support over the long run. Moreover, the government's favoritism towards certain firms such as keiretsu made it very difficult for new businesses or startups to get their start or succeed, potentially depressing the entrepreneurship, dynamism, and innovation of the Japanese economy over the long run. Finally, leaders around the world began to protest that Japan's protectionist policies, including import restrictions, foreign capital controls, and an undervalued currency, were creating distortions in global markets that advantaged Japanese keiretsu exporters at the expense of American or European firms. International critics contended that these protectionist measures would be both economically and politically unsustainable over the long run. While the Japanese government's economic coordination drew both praise and criticism, by the late 1960s, Japan's policies appeared to be a resounding success. Throughout the 1960s, Japan's exports expanded at an annual rate of more than 15%. But exports do not tell the whole story. Much of Japan's rapid growth during this period was driven by high domestic consumer demand, as Japan's population enjoyed higher incomes. From 1946 to 1976, the Japanese economy increased 55-fold. By 1976, Japan accounted for 10% of the world's economic activity, even though it contained only 3% of the world's population. Japan's rapid economic rise seemed unstoppable. However, by the early 1970s, the Japanese economy would encounter major challenges that would cast Japan's coordinated economic model into doubt.
Chapter 3: The Japanese Economy Confronts Global Challenges. By the 1970s, 1980s, the Japanese economy was reaching new heights. Japanese keiretsu were leaders in many of the world's most advanced fields, including semiconductors, electronics, and cars. By the 1980s, Japan's income per capita had surpassed that of the United States. However, this same period brought about a series of forces that began to challenge Japan's economic growth. One of the first shocks to this growth was the 1973 oil crisis, which dramatically increased global fuel prices. At the time, Japan was dependent on imports of Middle Eastern oil for nearly 60% of its fuel supply. So Japan was heavily impacted by the dramatic price increases. Rising oil prices increased the cost for consumer goods as well as for Japan's manufacturing sectors at a time when many of Japan's manufacturers were already facing strong global competitive pressures to cut costs. Consumer spending began to fall in response, and Japan faced increased pressure to grow exports in order to finance fuel and food imports. This period brought the Japanese public's attention to Japan's dependency on crucial imports. But Japan's biggest challenge was perhaps more political than economic. As Japan's exports soared and Japanese manufacturers gained global prominence, other developed countries took notice.
The continuing trade invasion by Japan is a central part of our economic problem and the continuing loss of American jobs. Through systematic, ruthless, predatory trading practice, Japan will once again this year have a $41 billion trade surplus with the United States. This predatory trading pattern by Japan is unfair, it's destructive, and it must be stopped before more of America's industrial base is destroyed.
The United States and Europe had high trade deficits with Japan, meaning that they bought many more goods from Japan than what Japan bought from them. Fear spread that Japanese exports were costing Americans and Europeans their jobs as domestic manufacturers struggled to compete with the quality and low price of Japanese goods. Many observers attributed Japan's export success to unfair trade practices. The United States and Europe accused Japan of engaging in adversarial trade, designed to benefit Japan at the expense of U.S. and European businesses. Indeed, while Japanese exporters benefited from global free trade agreements, the Japanese government erected high trade barriers to protect their own businesses, maintaining the second highest tariff levels of any developed country in the world. These Japanese barriers to trade drew criticism that Japan was trying to have it both ways, advocating for free trade when it benefited Japanese firms, while abandoning free trade by raising tariff barriers when it served them. Japan faced intense political pressure to reduce trade deficits between it and other nations, as well as to engage in fair trade by opening up their economy to foreign competition.
In addition to their protectionist trade policies, Japan also faced intense criticism over the weak value of its currency, the yen. Since the end of World War II, Japan had benefited from a global fixed exchange rate system that kept the Japanese yen undervalued compared to the US dollar. This weakness of the yen allowed Japanese exporters to sell their goods at very low prices in the US and abroad, which was a major advantage for Japanese exporters. Facing political and economic pressure from the US, major economies around the world, including Japan, abandoned the global fixed exchange rate system in 1971. As such, the world's major economies stopped fixing their exchange rates and instead began to allow their currency values to float more freely according to global market forces. This near-global shift from a fixed exchange rate regime to a more free market floating exchange rate system caused the yen to strengthen rapidly against the dollar. By 1973, the yen had strengthened by 132% against the dollar. Because of this stronger yen, Japanese exporters were now forced to sell their goods at higher prices, making it easier for US and European companies to compete. But this was not enough. Japan continued to face accusations that its currency was undervalued compared to the dollar, unfairly benefiting Japanese firms at the expense of US firms. US leaders faced pressure from manufacturers and labor union leaders to do something about the weak yen. In the words of one American Ford Motor Company executive, quote, "A strong dollar got us into this fix, and a weak dollar will help get us out." In 1985, the US government convened the leaders of Japan and other leading nations to address global currency values, including Japan's. In what is now referred to as the Plaza Accord, Japan and other countries agreed to take policy action to strengthen their currencies relative to the dollar, in the hopes that this would satisfy US concerns and stave off more drastic action. As a result, by 1988, Japan's yen had strengthened by another 200% against the dollar, putting even more strain on Japanese exporters. In Japan, this time period is called Endaka, which translates literally as high yen. Many Japanese exporters had to take extreme measures to cut costs to stay competitive. For example, in some of its factories, Toyota made Thursdays and Fridays the official weekend so that the factory could operate on Saturdays and Sundays when electricity was cheaper. This kind of creative cost-cutting by many Japanese exporters at this time was described as squeezing water out of a dry rag.
But interventions to strengthen the yen did not quell US or European concerns. Even while Japanese exporters were squeezed by strengthening the yen, the US and Europe's trade deficits with Japan continued to rise. By the mid-1980s, the value of Japan's exports to the US was more than double the value of US exports to Japan. Meanwhile, the stronger value of the yen allowed Japanese investors to buy up assets around the world for bargain prices, and Japanese investors acquired several prominent American real estate assets, including the Rockefeller Center. This widening US trade deficit, combined with high-profile Japanese acquisitions of U.S. real estate and other assets, further inflamed anxiety in the U.S. over the economic power of Japan. Responding to these criticisms and serious threats of tariffs, Japan took several steps to pacify its trading partners. Japan agreed to voluntary export reductions, in which the Japanese government agreed to limit the amount of cars or other goods it would export. Meanwhile, to comply with voluntary export reductions and import duties, some Japanese manufacturers shifted manufacturing to other countries, including the United States. For example, by the end of 1989, 30% of all Japanese cars for sale in the US were actually made in the US in Japanese-owned factories. These same Japanese factories employed over 26,000 American workers. All of these global pressures, from the oil crises to pressures from trading partners over Japan's trade policies and currency value, presented serious challenges to Japan's economic structure as an export-fueled economy. Straining under these and other pressures, Japan's economic growth began to slow. Chapter 4: Japan faces stagnation and crisis.
Faced with slowed economic growth in the late 1980s, many Japanese leaders considered deregulating the economy. The 1980s brought in an era of deregulation for many parts of the globe, and Japan was no exception. Prominent global leaders, such as President Ronald Reagan in the US and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in the UK, championed deregulation as a way to boost economic growth. Confronting slowing economic growth and fierce international political pressure, Japanese leaders had their own reasons to consider loosening regulations and opening up the Japanese economy. It was thought that regulations, restrictions, and preferential treatment initially implemented in the 1950s and 1960s to help early-stage Japanese businesses catch up to global rivals were no longer needed now that Japan's economy was well-developed. These same regulations that helped Japan catch up in the early days were now suspected to be hindering Japan's growth by preventing more organic, free-market innovation within Japan's maturing economy. Hoping to unleash more dynamism in the economy, in 1985, Japanese policymakers significantly deregulated many major industries, including finance, and by the end of the 1980s, Japan had some of the lowest tariff levels in the world. However, deregulation in the 1980s did not unleash free market growth as hoped. Instead, Japan entered a period of volatility and economic stagnation. In the wake of the Plaza Accord, which strengthened the yen, the Japanese government lowered interest rates to spur economic growth. But these low interest rates combined with deregulated financial forces caused Japanese real estate and stocks to soar in value, leading to a period of financial euphoria in major urban centers like Tokyo. But unbeknownst to many, these sky-high values were forming a financial bubble that would soon threaten the Japanese economy. While this bubble grew, real estate and stock prices ballooned so high it's almost impossible to imagine. For example, according to the Harvard Business Review, in 1988, the value of the land in a single one of Tokyo's downtown districts could purchase all of Canada. The theoretical value of all of the land in Japan was worth four times as much as all of the land in the US, despite the US being 25 times bigger than Japan. To make matters worse, less regulated banks were feverishly offering cheap loans to landowners based on the inflated value of their land, so people and businesses were taking out large loans against their land, loans that they could never pay off if land prices dropped.
And land prices did drop, dramatically. The real estate and financial bubble burst in 1990, causing mass bankruptcies and mirroring Japan in financial crisis and recession until 1993. As Japan sluggishly recovered, the government sought to spur more growth by enacting further deregulation in 1996. But any growth was stunted when the Asian financial crisis, which began in Thailand, spread financial panic to Japan in 1997, once again plunging Japan into recession. Due to these successive crises, the 1990s became known in Japan as the Lost Decade. During this time, Japan's economy fell behind in emerging fields related to the internet, where Silicon Valley and the United States began to dominate. By 2000, Japan's economic growth was slow or stagnant, and Japanese unemployment rose above 5% for the first time since World War II. To this day, Japan still struggles to reignite rapid economic growth. Between 1994 and 2019, Japan's GDP has largely stayed the same, hovering around $5 trillion. While this still makes Japan the third largest economy in the world, it means that Japan's GDP has not meaningfully grown in over 15 years. One reason is that Japan faced increased economic competition from other Asian nations, such as South Korea, Taiwan, and China, as they developed their own export industries. Another reason is Japan's aging and declining population, which has left the country with a smaller domestic demand engine and fewer workers to provide for the elderly. Finally, Japan has struggled with stubborn deflation, which further depresses demand and investment. What is clear is that Japan needs a new economic vision to lead them out of their economic slowdown, and the Japanese people are still searching for answers.
The future of Japan's miracle and lessons for the world. This has been the story of Japan's economic miracle. It was a miracle created not by any divine agent, but was rather the work of careful economic planning, powerful state intervention, and a distinct business environment, all driven by a uniquely Japanese economic vision that set Japan apart from the rest of the world. Japan's success in wielding state resources, forging national champions, and implementing careful protectionism nurtured Japan's economy from post-war devastation to 1980s euphoria and multi-year double-digit growth. But Japan's rapid success generated rancorous international backlash from established economic superpowers with the most to lose. It is difficult to say whether Japan's economic system collapsed upon itself due to the inefficiencies of state intervention pushed past its limits, or deregulation run amok, or if Japan's economic system was neutered by powerful players seeking to uphold their status as economic leaders. Whichever the case, the tale of Japan's mighty success and subsequent stagnation is a cautionary tale for another challenger of the economic order, the People's Republic of China. The parallels of Japan and China's rapid rise speak for themselves. Both nations reached meteoric economic heights just decades after total economic ruin, and China today utilizes immense state planning to build national champions, export high-value goods, and protect their own domestic markets while benefiting from open markets abroad. Much of the world has begun to push back against China's system of economic advancement, ushering in new trade wars over the same conflicts. Currency values, trade deficits, economic cheating, defending domestic jobs. Will China find itself repeating Japan's history? Or will China overcome the challenges that stunted Japan's rise? And how will the U.S. contend with this new, arguably stronger, economic rival?
And finally, turning our focus back to the future of Japan. Japan's miracle inspired economic policies all over the world. But has its economic miracle finally met its end? State interventionism led to its miracle, but are free markets the way forward? What is next for the world's third largest economy? Only one thing is certain. The world still has much to learn from the story of Japan.
As you may have noticed, this episode was different from our normal programming. This episode is part of our new narrative series, Up to Speed, where we will tell the stories of some of the most interesting developments in international affairs. If you like this narrative style, or hated it, please let us know. Shoot us an email at hopkinspofa@gmail.com, or send us a message on our Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook at hopkinspofa. Research, script writing, voiceovers, and audio editing for this episode was done by Megan Rutkai and Zach Wheeler. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.